much older then. I'm younger than that now.
It is time. Hi, everybody. I'm Mark Middleton, along with Bill Schaefer, and this is Growing Bolder. And coming up, we're going to talk with one of the leading voices in the exploding aging care industry. We'll ask her the question, are we headed for disaster?
Well, here's a great one. We're also going to meet a man who directed his very first feature-length film at the age of 81. And country music star Stella Parton will tell us what it's like to be the younger sister of one of the biggest stars in country music history.
And I cannot wait for this interview. We will speak with the oldest woman in history to ever finish a marathon. All of that and more coming up right now on Growing Bolder.
Our first guest is one of the true thought leaders in the field of aging today. She has a master's degree in public health administration and a master's in gerontology, and she's worked with older adults for over three decades. She is currently the president of the National Association of Aging Life Care.
She's a past winner of the National Entrepreneurial Achievement Award from American Express for her vision and innovation, and she's been named one of the 15 women who mean business by the Orlando Business Journal. Welcome, Amy O'Rourke. Hi, Amy. How are you?
Mark, I'm doing well. How are you?
Well, you know, we're doing great. And Bill and I were so thrilled to meet you and to learn that there are people like you out there, because as you know better than anybody, 10,000 of us are now turning 65 every day. And you don't have to be a whiz at math to know that the elder care industry could be literally overwhelmed in 15 or 20 years. Already a shortage of geriatric specialists. We've talked to medical schools who say there is little interest in most students in geriatric medicine. Are we headed for a crisis, Amy?
Are we headed for a crisis? We're absolutely headed for a crisis. The baby boomers are going to be creating change. They're going to be the great disruptors in healthcare as we know it. The crisis is that there are going to be people needing care and less people to provide the care. But I like to think creatively, and I like to think that with that bulge of people coming through the healthcare system, that we're going to have some real creative change take place in healthcare.
I'm not sure if visionary is the right word for you, but boy, you sure must have seen this coming. You've been working with the older among us for what, at least three decades. What attracted you to this that normally people want to keep at arm's length? And why does it seem so few others are interested in what appears to be an area of such great opportunity?
I tell you what interested me, and it was at a very young age, and I'm the most grateful for this experience. I was with an older adult in a nursing home when I was 13 years old, and it's real. There's no game playing. There's no, all the facade is gone. It's real, and they're dealing with real things. I would say it's the most intimate experience a person can have, because at 80, 85, 90, they're just going to tell you the way it is. And I find that refreshing, and it takes less work in a relationship because all the emotions are right on the surface.
Not long ago, Amy, it seems at least that the job of most in your industry was basically keeping the frail elderly safe and comfortable. That mission does seem to have changed a good bit, and is probably reflected in one of your company's slogans, making sure life gets better with age. Stimulating and engaging appears to have become a big part of the job for you guys now.
It is. It is. And I'd like to say that as the body becomes frail, all the inside components have the capacity to grow more. The wisdom, contentment, peace of mind, emotional generosity, courage, all the inner qualities, because all the focus is now on the inside of you, not on the outside. So the opportunities are huge for continued growth, especially when they turn back around and look at somebody that's younger than them to give them hope, perspective. I mean, the perspective when you're at 90 is so beautiful. To give that to somebody at age 65 is so hopeful and inspiring.
Well, your perspective is pretty inspiring, too, especially, folks, check out her TEDx talk, which she gave recently about taking the stress out of caring for someone late in life. And boy, is that a timely topic, because so many people are going through that now. And one point that you make, Amy, that really stuck in our minds is how hospitals and the ill people, older people, they just don't mix. They don't go well together.
No, they don't. They don't. And you know what? Everybody in the hospital knows it. They just haven't come up with a solution yet. But an older person is moving at a slower pace. They're more deliberate. And the hospital is designed for acute emergencies. So they're set up. The lights are fast. The noises, the nurses, the equipment, the moving, changing room to room. It is really scary for an older adult. And they don't know that long-term care, elder care, is better rendered at a much slower and more thoughtful pace. And a lot of times, and we've helped thousands of people, less care is actually the answer. Well, when you're in a healthcare setting, they're designed to provide more care. So the person helping the older person in the healthcare system has to really be conscious to slow everything down, stop, tell everyone this is not going to be a rush decision. Whatever the decision is to be made, this is not going to be a rush. We're going to be very, very thoughtful. And most of the time, less care is decided upon.
Folks, we're talking with Amy O'Rourke, who is one of the true thought leaders in the field of aging and caring for the aging. And Amy, just like you know your business, we have a pretty good idea of who listens to us. The cool thing is we have listeners and viewers from age 20 to age 90. But for the most part, the biggest percentage are women 45 to 65. That's the group that's taking care of their parents right now. There are over 40 million caregivers in the U.S., and I know that's one of your areas of expertise. Can you give us a word of hope to the caregivers about the job that they do, the difficulty of it, and how to avoid the stress that you talk about?
Oh, I can. I can. And what I would say to a child that's taking care of an aging parent, and I am one, that to check out your own expectations of you want your parent to get better or change in some way, let all of that go and be with your parent where they are. When I've seen kids do that, beautiful things happen. Connections happen that if you're in the stress of wanting life to be different than what it is with your parent, it becomes more simple and more more beautiful.
And, you know, it goes along with the two topics you were talking about, caregiving and hospitals. You know, 90% of the elderly in a survey say they want to die at home, but it never happens, like 30% of the time. So what are we doing wrong? How do we change that?
Well, I think there's a lot of anxiety that happens when you're caring for someone at home. And by that I mean they're exhibiting some medical symptoms and the kids get scared and they don't have a support network to say, don't call 911. Call, what is the relationship you have with your doctor? Do you have someone coming in at home that you can trust? Can you bring a nurse in? Is it really necessary to make the emergency room the person that needs to decide whether your older person even needs IV fluids? I got a call from a woman whose mother needed IV fluids, and we helped her arrange with her doctor for that care to be rendered at home and not go to the emergency room for regular care. But it takes a support network and courage on the part of the child or the caregiver to stop using the acute care system to manage care at home and to create, that creates a vacuum. You have to have a replacement support network to make arrangements for home. And there are lots of ways to do that. I wouldn't say lots of ways. I should say there are ways to do that, and there's going to be more ways because the numbers are going to drive care rendered at home.
So many questions, so many options, so much to think about. And of course, watching our parents decline is not only heartbreaking, Amy, I think it reminds us of our own mortality. And it's not hard then to extrapolate and begin thinking, well, you know, that's going to be me before too long. As one who has been at the front lines of this, who sees it daily, how has that honestly affected you and how you view aging? Do you fear it more? Do you dread it more? Or do you realize that there is, in fact, opportunity and good things to look forward to?
I think there's a give and take. I think that I learned more about myself watching my dad turn 87 and become frail himself. most of the time I have an appreciation for the days that are afforded to me. And I think I'm gleaning from my clients how to accept the changes in my body and my spirit and my energy level, which to me, most of the time, and sometimes I feel saddened when I watch a situation that I wish were otherwise, but every opportunity I've had is a learning for the next person that I come in contact for, my father, for my siblings, or for someone else. So if I can remain in a kind of a selfless mindset, that really spurs me on to help more and more people.
So from this perspective that you have, Amy, what would you say, I mean, do you have a takeaway you can leave us with when it comes to aging? What have you seen that a lot of us just don't like to look at?
I tell you, most people like to think that they're going to go the way they're going and then die in their sleep or die suddenly. And the scariest, most real thing they can look at is the frail time they're going to be in before they die. And by, I don't mean frail by a walker or a wheelchair, but just slower. And to prepare for a few years where your energy level just isn't where it is, and to accept that, and then schedule things for the stuff you enjoy. Let somebody else do the housework. Let somebody else do the cooking. Give away all that stuff that you've clung to do and save your energy for the fun stuff.
Folks, she is Amy O'Rourke, helping families deal in a positive way with the inevitable decline of aging. You know, there is a crisis, as she mentions, unfolding, and it's so good to know that there are people out there on the front lines helping us all understand and deal with it. Amy, thanks so much. Coming up, becoming a first-time director in his 80s and completing an official marathon in her 90s, those inspiring interviews are coming up on Growing Bolder.
Support for Growing Bolder provided by...
If you or a loved one are over 65 and need a ride, check out Uber. Many Medicare Advantage Flex cards help cover the cost of Uber rides to appointments and important deliveries with Uber Eats, like groceries and over-the-counter medication. Learn more at uberhealth.com/card or call 1-866-827-4584.
Mark and Biddle here on Growing Bolder. This is a story that every man and certainly every parent needs to pay attention to, and we thank Robert Hudson for sharing it with us. Robert's one of an alarming number of men who are coming down with throat and neck cancer.
Yeah, and what's especially frightening about this is that unlike the throat and neck cancers that doctors have been seeing for decades now, this one is appearing in younger men who are non-smokers, and it's increasing so rapidly that it's now being called an epidemic. Robert Hudson wasn't overly concerned when he felt a painless lump in his throat.
So I went to my primary doctor. He thought it was just an infection, gave me antibiotic.
When it didn't go away, his doctor ordered a scan and then a biopsy.
And I just looked at him and said, "Are you telling me I got cancer?" And he goes, "You do."
The cancer had already spread from his tongue into the lymph nodes in his neck. A good friend insisted that he meet immediately with Dr. Henry Ho.
I just knew immediately that he was the right guy. You know, of course, he was very highly recommended also. But beyond that, I just knew.
And he really had very little symptoms, which is typical for this type of cancer.
Robert's cancer has been linked to HPV, or human papillomavirus, a well-known cause of cervical cancer in women, and recently an alarming number of head and neck cancers in men.
This is almost an epidemic in our practice. The virus is acquired sexually, and it infects the tonsillar tissues and causes a genetic alteration, usually decades after the infection. The typical head and neck cancer when I was in training was the 67-year-old veteran who smoked. These people are 30, never smoked, no symptoms, so it's a whole different disease. The good part about it is the cure rate is very high.
Robert was scheduled for transoral robotic surgery, or TORS, a high-tech, minimally invasive surgery through the mouth that Dr. Ho helped pioneer in Florida.
It went very well. Got favorable margins, you know, in other words, getting it all out, and everyone felt that he did not need any further therapy.
During a routine visit a few months later, Dr. Ho noticed a very slight, subtle firmness at the back of his throat that appeared to be the typical scar tissue from surgery.
You know, I just had this, you know, again, intuition that that's just not right. And I woke up that night thinking, something's wrong here. This doesn't smell right. I've learned over the years to listen to the inner voice. And I called him up the next day and said, Robert, we need to get a CT scan. Just don't feel good about it. I mean, I'm not sure what I'm looking for, but let's just do it.
The scan revealed that Robert's cancer had returned and was now up against his spine and carotid artery. Dr. Ho performed another robotic surgery, and this time Robert underwent both radiation and chemotherapy. He's now cancer-free and determined to help others by spreading the word about the HPV vaccine for children.
Well, you got to do it. It's just not worth taking the risk. It's in 80% of the country, and it's dormant, and, you know, why it manifests itself, nobody knows.
And we have to prevent it. So we have to educate the youth. They have to get vaccinated. It's not just the girls, but the boys have to be vaccinated now. You want to get the vaccine before you're sexually active. Once you're sexually active, it's too late.
Robert has battled his way through a major health challenge with the help of Dr. Ho and a huge team of experts.
No one person has the answer. That is the danger. If all you got is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Multidisciplinary approach is that a patient is presented to our tumor board, and the input of all these specialists, we do a video broadcast from Winter Park Hospital to Celebration, to Altamont, to Kissimmee, to Orlando campuses, where those radiation oncologists, those surgeons, so we all collaboratively come up with a treatment plan.
I felt strongly that there had to be, you know, there was as good a care here in Orlando than anywhere else in the world.
Certainly, that is the kind of doctor we all hope to have, we all deserve to have, one who wakes up in the middle of the night thinking about us and trusting his intuition that something might be wrong.
Coming up, we'll meet the man who proves it's never too late to direct your first feature film. This is Growing Bolder.
Support for Growing Bolder provided by
Savings accounts should build wealth, not add expenses. Raisin gives savers access to high-yield savings accounts, money market deposit accounts, and certificates of deposit from over 70 banks and credit unions. Find, fund, and manage multiple savings products all through a single secure login. More information at raisin.com/growingbolder.
The following interview was recorded before the passing of our guest. I'm Bill Schaefer with Mark Middleton, and this is Growing Bolder. And our next guest proves that it is never too late to achieve your dream, even if it's something as out there as directing a feature film.
Yeah, and he didn't just direct it, Bill. He wrote the indie film The Boat Builder, and he didn't just get his friends to star in it. He cast the awesome Christopher Lloyd, best known for his role as Doc Brown in Back to the Future, and the TV veteran Jane Kaczmarek from the hit Malcolm in the Middle, and he did all of this in his 80s. Let's welcome Arnold Grossman. Hey, Arnold, how are you?
I'm well. Very well, thank you. I'm glad to be here, and this right now is my favorite subject, so I look forward to it.
Well, you know, you deserve all the attention that you're getting. Congratulations on the film. The Boat Builder is about a grumpy old guy and a neglected, scared orphan who form an unlikely bond, and then they realize that they really have more in common than they thought. Where did the idea for this story come from, Arnold?
It came from some things that really happened that I either was connected to through a distant relative or that I observed. I've always believed in following some advice I had way back when I was in college studying creative writing. The professor, Dr. Williams, an accomplished novelist, he said, if I give you one piece of advice as you go off and try and be a writer, that is, write only about those things that you know and also that you feel strongly about. And that was the case in the, here. I had heard about an orphan boy who was having a great deal of trouble going from one foster home to another, none of which worked out well, and he was facing going to an institution, and he really feared it. He didn't want it. And at the same time, I recall that a relative of mine had a father who had a similar problem at his end of the life scale. He was in his 70s at the time, and he just didn't know what was going to become of his life, and he was looking at the uncertainties of possibly also himself going into an institution. And he was a man who valued more than anything freedom, and he saw that being threatened as each year came by. And I thought, wait a minute, how about putting the two of them together in a story? That's how it happened.
Well, yeah, so you've got a great story, and that's one thing, Arnold, but then getting great actors to be able to deliver it. You just, you're on your first effort out, you got Christopher Lloyd and Jane Kaczmarek. I gotta ask you this, Arnold. What did they think when they heard that they would be working with a first-time director who happened to be in his 80s?
Okay, good question. First of all, the negotiation was done once we decided on going for Christopher, that when I first had my meeting with him, I went from Denver out to Los Angeles to meet with Christopher, have dinner with him, get acquainted. And the first thing I said when we sat down to dinner was, now, Mr. Lloyd, you do know that I'm a first-time director. He said, of course I know. My agent told me. Okay. Well, I want you to know, if you're uncomfortable with that in any way and would prefer to work with a more seasoned director, I would, of course, step aside. And he gave me that wonderful Christopher Lloyd look and said, wait a minute, did I not sign a contract to work with you? Well, yes. Did I not know that I would be working with a first-time director? I said, yes. He said, then what are we wasting our time for? Sit down. I'll have your back.
Wow.
And that's how it got started. He was wonderful to work with, very understanding, had no problem working with a first-time director. I had done many directing jobs throughout my career, but most of them were on films that had a length of 30 or 60 seconds in the commercial field, as well as some documentaries. I did direct a 90-minute documentary a number of years ago, so I knew my way around a set, as they say. But still, doing a feature film is different from all the work I did throughout my years. But I thought I was ready to try. And at that time, I had not heard about Growing Bolder, but I have to say, I could have said, yeah, I get that. I'm going to approach it boldly as I can. And you do have to do that when you take on something that has a good deal of unknown in it. When you are working with people like Christopher Lloyd, like Jane, who are icons in the film business, and of course Christopher also had a lengthy career on the stage, so it's easy to get intimidated. And one thing I told myself, and again it goes back to the line of Growing Bolder, if I'm intimidated and I let that show, then I'm going to have problems. So I did my best not to be, and having heard that Christopher said, I will have your back, that was enough for me, and he did. He has a wonderful sense of humor, too, about all that.
It's a great story. Folks, we're talking to Arnold Grossman, who, as you've noted, probably directed his first feature-length film in his early 80s. And, you know, you made a great point there, Arnold. You know, especially for creatives, there are always doubters, no matter what your age is. But you work in a notoriously ageist industry that doesn't encourage and certainly doesn't nurture people like you. It spits them out. Was it hard for you to ignore the fact that the odds of success were really stacked against you?
Yes, I did. But I think, again, rather than become intimidated by that, and you're absolutely right, that's the reality of it. The fact that I had a story that I could relate to. Christopher Lloyd, in real life, is almost my age, very close to it, within a couple of years. And also, the story has an appeal, I'm convinced, and I have been convinced from the beginning, to an older audience, to seniors. When this played in the two film festivals at which we were featured so far, it was very interesting. The audience was skewed to an older audience. The other thing is, when I go to theater to see films, movie theaters here in Denver, I go to a couple of theaters here that are independent theaters, not part of any chain, and they tend to show independent films. And very often those films have a story that has to do, again, with that generation, my generation. And in a couple of recent films like The Marigold Hotel, and there's a new one that's just out I haven't seen yet, called The Lady in the Van. When I go there, I look around at the end of the showing, and I look at the audience, and most of the hair is the same color as mine. And I think that, you know, speaking to that audience, even though it is also a story about a child, it still remains, in my view, it's a family story, and I think its primary appeal is going to be with an audience somewhere around 55 plus.
That's beautiful. Hey, Arnold, we've got about 15 seconds, 20 seconds. What can we learn from your struggles and your success? What's the Arnold Grossman takeaway?
Okay, as quickly as I can say it, what I'm living by at this stage of my life is don't live in the past, honor the past, learn something from the past, but by all means, start living in the present and the future. Don't look back and expecting it to repeat itself. And that's what guided me.
That's a great takeaway. Speaking of the future, Arnold, now that we got people wanting to see your film, The Boat Builder, still doing the film circuit thing, or can we expect a DVD or Netflix sometime?
We don't have the next one scheduled yet, but I do want to let your listeners know that they can learn more about the film by going to either our website, which is theboatbuildermovie.com, or we're on Facebook with simply The Boat Builder.
Folks, he is Arnold Grossman, the man who proved it's never too late, even in the notoriously ageist film industry, by making his first feature film in his 80s. The film is The Boat Builder, starring Christopher Lloyd and Jane Kaczmarek. Coming up, wait until you hear what she had to overcome to achieve her dream in her 90s. More proof that if you're growing bolder, it is never too late. That's next. Growing Bolder and Humana are celebrating the opportunity of aging and smashing stereotypes with the new 65 Plus. We're sharing examples of people 65 and older who are pursuing their passions and leading happy, healthy, and active lives. You can inspire others by sharing your own photos and stories. Find more information at growingbolder.com/new65plus.
The following interview was recorded before the passing of our guest.
My guard stood hard when abstract threats to noble.
I'm Bill Schaefer with Mark Middleton, and this is Growing Bolder. Sit down, get quiet wherever you are, because you're going to love this. Our next guest is a 92-year-old, three-time cancer survivor, grandmother of 10, and that alone is more than enough to make her someone worth listening to. But get this, she's also a marathon runner.
And not just that, Bill. She, in fact, became the oldest woman in history to complete an official marathon when she completed last year's Rock and Roll Marathon in San Diego at the age of 92. Let's welcome the inspirational Harriet Thompson. Hey, Harriet.
Hi.
How
That's
are
a nice introduction.
Well, you know what? You deserve that and more, because what you did is so inspiring. 26.5 miles in 7 hours, 24 minutes, and 36 seconds at the age of 92. What about
yes,
that?
Let me correct one thing. It was 26.2 miles.
26.2. I was adding the little bit that you walked to the starting line and then walked back. And then walking back to the ambulance. No, thank you. You're right. What about that appeal to you, Harriet?
What about it appeals to me?
Yes.
Oh, it's very exciting. It's one of the most interesting things. I feel at my age, if I can do anything to inspire anybody, that that's very nice. But my main reason to run is to help the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. I raise funds for that, their research.
Now, Harriet, that is so interesting. Did that have anything to do with losing your husband after 67 years?
No, it had nothing to do with that. My husband never even went out with me to San Diego. I've been out there this June it'll be 17 times, and he was always very supportive of my running. But when I go out there, I really don't have any time to spend with him, so it's sort of unnecessary for him to go, because I like to be completely free, and I don't want to feel like I have to entertain him. So he was very supportive, though.
But I think what Bill was alluding to is the fact that your husband did die of cancer, and you are a three-time cancer survivor. Both of your parents and three brothers died of cancer, and so your connection to cancer goes way back before your husband died. But that is what got you into running, isn't it? A desire to help out?
Yeah, that's the reason I run, is to be able to help out.
And as you've mentioned, you've run the San Diego Marathon 16 of the last 18 years. It is, in fact, the only marathon that you ever run in. Why San Diego, and why only San Diego?
Well, I started when I was 99 that I did the first one, and I liked San Diego so much, and I just realized that that was the first time they had the run for leukemia and lymphoma. So I really am sort of drawn to San Diego, because it's not only a beautiful city, but it's not a terribly hilly city, so I can handle that. Although the hills do get a little bit larger as I age, they get more like mountains. But on the whole, it's just a wonderful experience. The weather is wonderful. It's about 66 degrees each time, so that's not hard for a runner. And it's very entertaining. The city itself has a lot to offer. Not just the one marathon that I think it's the only time I want to ask anybody for money too. I don't want to do it more than one time a year, so that's the reason I do San Diego.
Well, you shouldn't even hesitate when it's for such a good cause, Harriet. And, you know, what? Getting to talk to a 92-year-old, I think a lot of people would spend most of their time talking about that person's past. But that's what sort of sets you apart, because we want to talk about your future. Do you think you'll run again at the age of 93? And do you think you have a chance to break your own record?
I would say if I didn't have a wound on my leg from radiation, I would say I could beat my record. But I'm nursing right now. I'm nursing that wound with hyperbaric treatments, and right now I'm carrying a vacuum around. They're trying to get the debris out of the wound. So I'm hoping that that will heal enough so that I can run. But I'm not sure I'll be able to break my record. I'll just be happy if I can get out there and try to do it.
We are talking with the inspirational Harriet Thompson, who is the oldest woman ever in the history of humankind to run in and complete an official competitive marathon, 26.2 miles. And just to make sure people don't think that you have been running all your life, Harriet, you only started running when you were in your late 70s. You only started running to try to make a difference in the battle against cancer. And you have personally raised over $100,000. That's got to feel good.
It does. And right now I'm receiving checks from friends for this next run, and they're very generous, and they say even if I don't run, they'll still give me money. But I just think, as I said before, it's nice to know that I can do something at my age to help that cause and to inspire people, because when I'm running, these young people go by me and they say, "You're the reason I'm running." And that makes me feel good that I can have some effect at this age.
Yeah, and you mentioned the young people. I read an article about when you finished that race, and it sounded like a rock star had just arrived on stage. I mean, you were unbelievably well-received. How did that feel?
Oh, I just am amazed. I went to Germany this year. They thought I had made an impact in 2015, and they had everybody from all over the world whom they thought made an impact. And I was so pleased to be included. That was a wonderful. It was a television show on December the 17th, I think, in Germany. And it was filmed and it was broadcast all over Europe.
Everybody needs a little bit of what Harriet Thompson has. Harriet, you're also a concert pianist. We'll talk about that another time. But give us a takeaway. You know, what can we learn from you about life? What can we do to be more like you when we are in our 90s?
Well, that's very flattering. What I would say is that perhaps the nicest thing that helps me is to think positively and not to dwell on anything. I don't try to think negatively at all, and that's one of my main incentives and also I think about something like my music when I'm running that helps me. And I think if people just don't feel that they're hampered because of age, they can do it. If I can do it, they can do it.
She is an unintentional trailblazer, an ordinary woman who has accomplished something extraordinary, completing an official marathon at the age of 92, and by doing that, showing us all what's possible. Thanks to her, there will be many more like her in the years ahead. Our thanks to Harriet Thompson. Coming up, she's a successful country singer whose last name is Parton. Maybe you've heard of her. That's next on Growing Boulder. We've got news. Watch.growingboulder.com, the world's first streaming site for active adults, is now live. Growing Boulder TV shows, national specials, documentaries, and inspiring videos on ordinary people living extraordinary lives 24/7 on demand for free. Watch.growingboulder.com is now live.
There is nothing like a beautiful voice and a great song to get us going in this segment. You're listening to Growing Boulder with Bill Schaefer and Mark Middleton. And guess who our next guest is? A singer, songwriter, entertainer, actress, author, speaker, and philanthropist. She has released 16 original studio albums, charted numerous country singles. You've seen her on TV, on Broadway, and in film.
Her last name is Parton, and her first name is Stella. Yep, she's Dolly Parton's sister. Her latest project is a tribute to Dolly called Mountain Songbird, an album of re-recorded songs previously made famous by Dolly, including the title track, which you've been listening to, Mountain Songbird. Let's say hello to Stella Parton. Hello, Stella. How are you?
Hey, guys. Good morning. Hello, everybody. I am great today, and Mountain Songbird is a song that I wrote. In tribute to my sister. The rest of the songs are Dolly's songs.
Well, thank you for that, because that was my bad. It is a fabulous song. You know, you've made a great career in your own right. You will always be, for better or for worse, Dolly's sister. She cast a pretty big shadow. But obviously, based upon this project, Stella, you're not only not bothered by that, you have embraced that.
Well, you know, I like to think of it this way. My sister and I have great love for each other. We've always had each other's backs in spite of what some people may think. But, you know, having grown up together in the same house and going to school together and sleeping in the same bed together, you do have to have each other's backs. And I love her dearly, and who wouldn't be honored to be the little sister of Dolly Parton?
Is there something in your genetics or something? I mean, I'm going to guess, and I hope I don't offend you, but I'm guessing you're in your mid-60s, but busier than ever, looking more vibrant and energetic than ever. You sound fantastic, and you're getting ready to embark on a tour of England now. Are you still loving life as much as you sound?
You know, I still think of myself like a little girl. And, you know, I know I've been here a long time, but my mother said when she was in her 80s, she said, well, Stell, she said, I'm still just a little girl. I've just been here longer. And I realized that's kind of how we are. We just have that childlike spirit in us. And I never have thought of myself as a male or a female, black or white or red or green. I've just always seen myself as a human being, and I've operated from that standpoint in my heart and soul and consciousness. And I leave all that other stuff alone because it means nothing to me in the creative life that I have chosen to live.
Man, I think you guys definitely got the optimistic gene in the Parton family. You know, one of the songs on your album, Stella, is Coat of Many Colors, which, of course, Dolly turned into a film about your childhood. And you are not only portrayed in the film as a young girl, you have a part in it. How was that seeing your childhood come to life on the screen?
Well, for lack of a better word, it was quite poignant and surreal in many ways, because I had to relive a lot of that stuff. My sister was in L.A. suffering from a kidney stone attack and was not able physically and medically to make it to the set. So I ended up having to serve as the consultant on the film throughout the entire filming, even though I was in the film as Corla Vass. I played the gossipy old church lady. But to see us as little children, and I really had to not get too emotional seeing my mom and dad at that age and thinking of them already gone. But it was sweet. And when Dolly and I were in L.A. At the studio going in to see the private screening before the red carpet event, and we were holding hands when we got out of the car, and she said, don't you think this is really wild that here we are getting to see ourselves on film, and we're just little mountain girls from East Tennessee? I said, yeah, it's pretty wild. So that's kind of the way I saw it, too. It's like, is this for real?
And people love the Partons. The film was a major hit on NBC, making it the highest rated movie on any of the major networks in more than 3 years. You must have been over the moon about that.
We were. We were so shocked, but it was actually the highest rated in 6 years of all three networks, is from my understanding, and it was over 17 million people with because they played it again, or they showed it again on Christmas night, and they first showed it on December 10th. So we are just still beside ourselves, and we're so excited because it had such great response to it. They're discussing a sequel, so we'll let you know more about that soon.
We just cannot get enough of the Partons. And, you know, I've got a confession to make, Stella. In preparing for this interview, I actually visited your Facebook page this morning. And I have to say, I stayed on there longer than I had planned, and I left feeling optimistic and grateful. You are quite an encourager.
Well, you know, honey, I see people get so negative on social media, and I decided, you know, if I was going to have a Facebook page and if I was going to be interactive, because I don't have other people doing that, I do it myself. And if somebody's real nasty, I'll scold them for it. Because I'm old enough and been around long enough to, I'll call you out if you're being ugly. But I feel like I'm a messenger of hope. You know, I never thought I was a great singer or a beautiful woman or any of that. I was always lucky to be here and very grateful that God gives me inspiration. And when I can wake up every day, I want to try to inspire somebody else. So it's Christmas every morning on my Facebook page.
You know, nobody ever handed you guys anything. You had to work your way up through a very, very difficult industry and in a very difficult career. Stella, how do you know, so now in the good times, we all get what it must be like, but how do you get over the times when you're not sure where things are going or where you are in life?
All you have is your faith. And, you know, if God can bring you to it, then he can bring through it. It's how I try to look at it.
You know, in addition to your music, Stella, you have been active in many, many worthy causes. Mothers Against Drug Driving. You've been an ambassador for the American Cancer Society. But what really caught our eye is that you teach at the new Opportunity School for Women at Berea College in Kentucky. What are you teaching them? Why do you do it?
Well, I figure, you know, I've been through divorce. I've been through domestic violence. I've seen lots of horrible things happen to a lot of very good, virtuous women. And for me, I feel like that I need to be an advocate and utilize the bad things that have happened to me and turn them into positives. You know, that old saying, take lemons and make lemonade. Well, I make lemon pie, too. So I take all the things that I've learned over the years. I have a cosmetology background, professional makeup and hair and all that stuff, and so I try to teach them how to do their hair, their makeup, their skincare products from the kitchen, and how to go find a wardrobe at the Salvation Army or at the Goodwill store, and you can just keep right on going. It's not about how much money you have. It's about how creative you are.
And Stella, in our last 30 seconds or so, you guys have been successful without being negative and without being shocking and without being over the top like it seems you need to be today. So what can you share with us about what's really important about life and reputation?
Well, you know, let's face it, I'm 5 feet tall. My sister's 5'1", something like that. And I figure if people treat me like a lady, then I'll act like a lady. If you're not going to treat me like a lady in business, then I can walk out of your office so fast in a pair of 5-inch stilettos and never look back but still be a lady. I think women don't have to act like men to be strong. I think women, you know, it's kind of like my mother and my grandmother always said, the hand that rocks the cradle rules the world. And you get a lot more flies with honey than you do with vinegar, so just try to treat people the way you want to be treated, and God will take care of the rest.
She is Stella Parton. What a breath of fresh air. Her latest album, folks, is called Mountain Songbird, A Sister's Tribute. 11 of Dolly's hits and 2 new songs available at Amazon, iTunes, other online retailers. She's getting ready for a UK tour. And check her out on Facebook because you will leave feeling inspired as we did. Thanks so much, Stella. Before we go, did you know that those with negative outlooks on aging have shakier handwriting, poorer memories, higher rates of cardiac disease, and far lower odds of recovering from severe disability? It's true. Becca Levy, who's a professor of epidemiology and psychology at Yale, says negative stereotypes about aging are a serious public health issue. Aging is the adult's version of the monster under the bed that we all feared as kids, and just like that crazy notion kept us from sleeping well, this one keeps us from aging well. Remember, aging is not a disease, it's an opportunity. So get out there and start growing bolder, and we'll see you next time.
The Growing Bolder Radio Show is a production of Growing Bolder, LLC, all rights reserved. This program was recorded at Growing Bolder Studios in Orlando and is available as a weekly podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Spotify, and TuneIn. It is written and produced by Jill Middleton, Mark Middleton, and Bill Schaefer. Technical director is Jason Morrow. Production manager is Michael Nanis. Chief audio engineer is Mac Dula. And our most important team member, you. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram to keep growing bolder every day.
Crimson flames tied through my ears, flowing high and mighty trapped. Countless fires. Said I, proud neath heated brow. Ah, but I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now. Half-right prejudice leap before, rip down all hate I screamed.
so much older then. I'm younger than that now.
Here a soldier stands, I aim my hand at the mongrel dogs who teach. Fearing not, I'd become my enemy in the instant. Stern to bow. Ah, but
I was so much older then. I'm younger than that now. Sure.